how can we design spaces that make us measurably healthier, happier, and more productive? Join us on Built for Health, where we talk with public health professionals, researchers, and AEC practitioners on the latest knowledge and strategies to design, build, and operate healthier buildings. I'm Flavia Gray. I'm a Schneider Fellow at USGBC, and I'll be your host on Built for Health, brought to you by USGBC. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Built for Health. I'm Flavia Gray, and today we will be talking about biophilia with Professor Peter Ken from the Department of Psychology at the University of Washington, and Bill Browning from Terrapin Bright Green. They will tell us about their professional journeys, the benefits of interacting with nature, and strategies and approaches of biophilic design.
Hi, I'm Bill Browning. I am a partner in Terrapin Bright Green. We are a research and consulting firm working in the green building space. We do a fair amount of work on biophilia, biophilic design. We also do work in ecosystem services and metrics around that, and a lot of work on sort of crazy big complex green buildings.
I'm Peter Kahn, and I'm a professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Psychology and the School of Environmental and Forest Sciences. And I direct the Human Interaction with Nature and Technological Systems Lab. So I'm interested in this intersection of depth of relationship with nature, and also as our technologies are exponentially growing in their computational sophistication and pervasiveness, what the interactions with those are in the intersection of nature and technology.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So one of the things that came up in both of your presentations is that we're already touching today's topic, biophilia. But for our audience, why don't we start by explaining what is biophilia?
Well, A.O. Wilson coined the term in 1984 and referred to it as an innate affiliation that people have with nature and natural systems. And Wilson, coming off from an evolutionary's perspective, argued, and I think argued rightly, that for tens and hundreds of thousands of years, we came of age with a vibrant, natural, rich world. And that since the architecture of our minds and bodies and our spirits are deeply interwoven with the natural world. And then in the Neolithic period of 10,000 years ago, as we moved from Paleolithic to agriculture, then from agriculture to modernity, that has we've shifted to increasingly technological and urban world. But Wilson and Steve Kellert's account of biophilia, and again, I share this perspective, is that we are still, in a sense, tethered to this deep need for nature, and that we flourish when we are connected to nature. And that's the broad umbrella around biophilia.
Yeah, it's really astonishing to see sort of the impacts both psychologically and physiologically when this connection gets made, and the science and the research that Peter and others are doing is becoming more and more compelling and deeper and deeper. You see it not just psychologically, but you see then the physiological response to that experience. And so that's something that can be incredibly beneficial, particularly in a stressful situation of living in urban environments where people are attenuated from experiences of nature. And so looking at, we're not going to be able to restore forests in the center of most cities or bring back all the original habitat in many of those settings. And so how do we bring back experiences of nature into the built environment to gather those benefits?
That's really interesting, because I feel that before, when we were living in more rural lives, interaction with nature was so common that you didn't really have to think about, is there a benefit to this? Because that's the way that people were living. And it's becoming more and more important as we move into cities. And so as more and more people are moving into cities and there is certain alienation from nature, how does that affect us?
I mean, on a science level, I think we can say that studies have shown, and this is building on the ideas Bill just was highlighting, that interaction with nature can reduce stress and reduce depression and reduce aggression, reduce diabetes, reduces obesity, reduces ADHD symptoms, it improves immune function, improves mental health. I mean, the literature is of hundreds of studies now that people have been bringing together substantiate that. And so when we don't have that interaction, then in a sense, you have the reverse. You know, years ago, Paul Shepard wrote a book called Nature and Madness and talked about the alienation that you're speaking about, Flavia, on the alienation from nature. And so on a more common sense perspective, we're going crazy. I mean, just to kind of say it straight, I think in many ways, and this is what Paul Shepard was saying decades ago, we are a diseased society. And increasingly a diseased world. I mean, in the United States, one third of us are obese, two thirds of us are overweight, asthma 7%, diabetes is high. I mean, the list is on and on. And it's insane. If you look at it, we should be up in arms. It's going this, we need a major revolution for the world we're creating. But we get used to this. This is tied to adaptation. We adapt to it, and then there's a shifting baseline that happens where each generation comes of age with a new normalized view of what normal is, but it's not normal. It's impoverished. It's diseased, but people aren't recognizing it. And so part of the power then, since we are part of a scientific culture, is to build on the scientific worldview and to bring the science forward to help people see the importance of nature in our lives.
You were talking about adaptation. So how does it differ for the new generations, as you were saying, who are born in cities and are not used to playing around or spending much time in nature?
Yes, I've talked about this idea in what I've called environmental generational amnesia. And the idea here is that each generation is born into an increasingly impoverished natural world and constructs a new baseline for what normal is, but the normal is already increasingly impoverished. The key issue, overlaying it with what Bill and I were talking about in terms of biophilia, is that even as we adapt, not all adaptations are good for us. I mean, if we were put into a prison cell, most of us would not die. We would adapt to it, but just because we would adapt to it doesn't mean we would do well physically and psychologically. And so I think that's what's happening to us now at a cultural level and in effect as a species level, as we increasingly build increase in population and increasingly move to denser and denser urban areas.
Judy Herwegen points out that zoos used to have cages that were basically like prison cells, and we no longer consider that to be acceptable for zoo animals, and yet we still build office buildings with cubicles that are much like that and think that's acceptable for humans. And so, yeah, if we made that leap for zoo animals, maybe we should make that leap for ourselves.
In a way, I feel it's like we're changing how much we interact with nature and what are the different approaches that we have of interacting with nature. And so before, we used to be surrounded and immersed in nature, but we've been stepping back from it. How do you guys think about what interacting with nature is? Is it important to at least begin to just see versus touching versus being immersed?
Well, I think some of it we know intuitively already. I will sometimes ask groups a question. I said, okay, so where do you go on vacation? How many folks go to the beach? How many folks go to the mountain? How many folks go to a national park? How many go to their office? And very few, usually just a few architects, say, oh, I go to my office. But otherwise, you know, most folks are to get restored, to get refreshed, they tend to go to those natural environments and have those experiences there. And so for us then, okay, so if we intuitively know that's what makes us feel happy and that's where we get restored and refreshed, how do we bring those qualities back into the built environment? And what Peter's work has been showing, and work by Roger Ulrich and others, is that in some cases, we can't bring real nature into the space. It's just not possible. We're doing some work in industrial bakeries right now. They're sterile spaces by definition. We can't even have natural materials in those spaces. But that doesn't mean that those people who are in that space for 8 hours a day shouldn't have some connection to nature. And so we're looking at technological ways to bring experience of nature into an otherwise completely, by definition, sterile space.
Which I think is fabulous. The caveat that I would raise is that from my body of research on technological interacting with the technological substitutions of nature is that usually you can get some benefits, but you can they're not as good or strong as the benefits of interacting with actual nature. So I think what Bill's highlighting is that in those spaces where there is very limited or no access to nature, then we can do improvements with it. But the worry that I have is that as we destroy more and more nature and increasingly live in urban environments that are increasingly dense, that we will be then thinking that since we get some benefits from technological nature, then we don't really need real nature anymore because we're benchmarking it not against actual nature, but against nothing. And then that will allow more technological nature to get developed, but it will also not provide a way to shut down the destruction of nature.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point. And in the case of these bakeries, outside of the buildings, they're doing a bunch of habitat restoration and actually creating habitats. And in the break areas and the non-sterile spaces of the buildings, they've sort of gone wild with biophilic design interventions, use of natural materials, looking at putting in water features, putting in plantings, creating refuge spaces, sort of more than you would typically do otherwise for those periods when the people aren't in the sterile spaces to give them the immersion and contact with real actual nature.
Yeah, that's marvelous. You can see similar things with hospitals settings and what you can do within the hospital itself and what you can do then just outside the hospital in terms of healing gardens, not just for the patients, but for the doctors and other staff.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see how much the employee retention numbers change on hospitals that have healing gardens that the staff can use along with the patients. It really, really changes the stress level of the staff and their ability to stay in those stressful environments.
Yeah. The one thing I would add, Flavia, based on your initial question was, for me, what I would like to highlight is the importance of not simply visually interacting with nature, but using all of our senses for the interaction. And I think we tend to be overly indulgent, in a sense, predisposed to using vision as our sensory mode. I mean, when Bill talks about so many people go to the ocean or beach and it's so restorative. But if you think of two types of interactions, one is you're sitting on a bluff top in your car looking out onto the ocean. That could be called a nature beach experience. Or you could be along the beach, shoes off, walking along the water with, in and out of the waves. And those two experiences are vastly different in terms of both the physical, psychological effects and also in terms of the human spirit. One of them in the car is focused largely on vision as the sense, the walking, all of the senses involved. So when I think about design or biophilic design, I'm calling it now, some of my work is focused on what I call interaction pattern design, trying to think about ways of emphasizing designs that emphasize the interaction with all of the senses and not relying upon vision. And I think much of Bill's work is focused in that way as well.
Yeah, we find that I'm trained as a designer, so as a designer, we'll tend to default to what does it look like? And in many cases, particularly with biophilic design, we need to get into what does it smell like? What does it feel like? What's the temperature of the surface? What's the sound it's making? All of those things. And we find that when you combine those different senses together, the impact is so much stronger and so much more memorable.
Part of what Bill has been doing is quantifying effects in the built environment based on some of his post-occupancy studies. And it's just really important work, and it's been hard to do, and I hope he'll speak a little about it. The other part, I think, to human nature interaction that is equally important but is that which is non-quantifiable. And I think that there's parts of human consciousness that are not, we're not just machines, we're not computational systems only. And the depth of awareness, I mean, when Wilson talks about the human spirit, you can talk about the spirit and either be a transcendentalist or not. I mean, there's something deep about consciousness that can access a type of awareness in space that is some of the deepest parts of our human existence. I mean, and I think we've all experienced this when we've been outside in nature and our thinking slows down. But just because our thinking slows down doesn't mean we're dumbing down. In effect, other parts of our brain are being activated. We're highly alert, but in a very quiet sort of way. And also, the more wild an area is, I think the more the wildness of the area demands not simply a restorative quality, but it demands attention as well, but a very quiet sort of attention. So there's something deep and beautiful of that form of interaction with not just domestic, but more wild forms of nature that are not simply tied to the metrics of what are the physiological benefits and mental benefits, but something that speaks to, again, what someone like Yale Wilson talks about in terms of the human spirit. So I just would like to have that as part of our discussion so that as we talk about benefits of nature, that we don't end up, in a sense, using nature or dominating over nature, yet again, trying to get something from nature for our benefits. Because in some ways, I think one of the central overarching problems of our world today is that we see ourselves in domination over other people and over nature. And if we just treat nature as another thing, as a resource to get benefits from, I think we're missing what the actual relationship is between humans and nature.
One of the relationships I'm always fascinated by is just the experience of awe in nature. So standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, walking through a redwood forest, scuba diving in a kelp forest, or on a really healthy coral reef, and just that experience that rarely occurs in the built environment. I mean, it does maybe in a great cathedral, but or a great religious space, but it is a experience that touches you on sort of the spiritual religious level, regardless of your background, and that's not something you can quantify, not something in that, but it is a profound experience that that is most frequently occurs in nature.
Great. So let's move on to explaining a little bit about biophilic design. So this has been a great introduction because we've been making some of the examples, talking about the bakery, about different approaches that we can take. But let's go back to explain what is biophilic design and what are some of the approaches that we can take to address it.
For us, biophilic design is really about how do we bring some of those experiences of nature into the built environment. And we find that the science sort of falls into three broad categories. The first one we call nature in the space, and which Stephen Kellert called direct experience of nature. And it's really that, trying to find ways to bring direct experiences of nature into the built environment. So plants, animal, water, sunlight, air movement, different experiences of thermal experiences, smell, sound, direct experiences of nature in the built environment. The next category are what we call natural analogs, and these are indirect experiences of nature, and so they're representational nature. So it's ornamentation references nature. It's the use of biomorphic forms. It's a dance between complexity and order that you see in nature and in really great architecture. It's the use of fractals in the built environment. And then the third category are physical aspects of the three-dimensional space, what we call nature of the space. And these are spatial patterns that elicit very distinct responses. And there are four of those that we've been pursuing most heavily. We're looking at some others, but the four are prospects, so an unimpeded view through space. Refuge, a space where you are protected, nurtured, and sheltered. Typically, your back is protected, and you may have some canopy overhead. Mystery, or some researchers call it enticement, where there's some information offered, but not complete information about what's ahead of you. And you just sort of feel compelled to go around that path in the corner or up that curving street to see what's around, what's next. And mystery is a fun one because people assume that it's just visual, but you can do mystery quite well with sound and scent. You know, think about the bakery that's putting its exhaust out onto the sidewalk, and you just have to go smell and see what's in that bakery window. And then finally, risk peril, which is where there's potential danger, but also implied safety. So it's the, you know, it's the balcony overlooking the high cliff. You know, it's the stepping stones through the pond. It's things like that. So risk peril. Risk peril is a fun one. You don't want to use too much of it. and so these are, and we find that these strategies really support a lot of different design because they're not fixed as, here are the exact dimensions, you know, how you have to do it. They're more, here's the nature of the experience you're trying to create in the space. And that gets modified by culture. It gets modified by the climate, by your building traditions. There are many, many, many ways of having those experiences. So what we were trying to catalog, and what we've cataloged at least initially now, are what we call 14 patterns of biophilic design. So 14 different experiences that help support biophilic responses in the built environment.
Perfect. So why don't we give some specific examples? So you were talking, for example, about the bakery. What are some specific techniques that were used in this project? For example, nature in the space.
So for nature in the space, in the bakery itself, in one of the bakeries, we were able to get some windows in, which doesn't sound like a huge innovation, but in a sterile space actually was quite difficult to get allowed to put windows in. And those are great. They benefit, they have a view out to the landscape, which are a benefit for the daytime shifts, but not quite as helpful for the folks who can't see out to the landscape at night. So within the space, the company is looking to put up projectors that will project images of nature onto these huge, very tall white metal walls. And because of their social media feed, they get pictures of people out eating their products on a kayak, on a beach, in the mountains, in the forest. And so those will change on a daily basis. In the break spaces and outside the building, they're doing work to restore native habitats. They've got areas where people can go out and sit and experience nature. They've got, they're working on also interior courtyard gardens for when it's not not too pleasant to be outside, even looking at water features in those. So looking at ways of direct experience of nature when I'm in the non-sterile spaces.
So thinking about nature in the space, what are some of the obstacles that you find? You were talking in this case about the sterile environments, but for offices, houses, other type of buildings, how do you convince people of what are the issues that they have to deal with?
Most people's assumption is that when we talk about nature in the space and bringing biophilic experiences into the built environment, they assume that we just mean plants and water. And those are good things to have, but even those need to be thought about how we put them in. If we just put in a monoculture of ivy completely covering a wall, that's pretty, but not as effective as actually having a smaller area that's highly biodiverse, or putting in a monoculture of ficus trees all through the office. Pretty nice, better than nothing, but actually more effective is to have a couple, one or two small clumps of maybe a ficus with three or four other plants around it that create this, in effect, micro habitat. And we look at those, and it's sort of like the difference between looking at a really beautiful little bonsai and the same plant just in a pot. And one looks like a little habitat, and we project ourselves into that, and the other is a pretty plant. And we kind of make distinctions between those two. But bringing variable light and bringing daylight into a space, having the ability to open windows and hear the sounds outside, feel the breeze, those sorts of things are really powerful biophilic experiences. So things like that are other ways of bringing nature into the built environment.
Okay. What about the natural analogs?
So in the natural analogs, there are several techniques. One are our use of patterns, for instance, that are analogs of nature. So, and you know, you see obviously fabrics and decoration that are leaves and flowers and that's been done from time immemorial. There's a lot of symbolic nature to that, but there's also, you know, responses around that. We're also seeing designers who are saying, okay, we're going to create a carpet pattern that mimics moss or mimics stone. It's not fake stone, it's not fake moss, but it has some of the qualities both texturally and visually. And people seem to respond very strongly to that. Use of natural materials. People have exhibited a really strong preference for natural materials. And we've talked to some folks doing research in that, and they're not sure if it may be because of sort of what they call semantic contact. I see wood, and I know that that came from a tree, and I know that was alive, and so I sort of treat that as an experience of nature. Or because when I look at a piece of wood, no two pieces are the same, and you see sort of embedded layers of mixed patterns in those. So you see a fractal nature to that as well, and we have a very, very strong preference for fractals. Fractals elicit a very strong brain response, particularly moving fractals. You know, we'll sit in front of a fireplace for hours, fascinated. There's no rational reason why I should do that, but it's really quite amazing. We'll sit and watch waves for a very long time as well, and that's moving fractals as well. So those are ways of thinking about natural analogs. Nature in the space are, of course, the spatial configurations. And, you know, you can play this game of, one of the questions we'll typically ask people is, if I come into a restaurant and you have your choice of spaces in the restaurant, the round tables in the middle, or high back booths around the perimeter, where do most people like to go first? Most people typically vote for the high back booths. Now, when I'm in the high back booth, I have, my back is protected. I've got this amazing little refuge space. but I also tend to have the view across the whole rest of the restaurant. So now I have prospect and refuge combined. Another classic example would be there's so many great cities that have beautiful old craftsman bungalows. And a lot of those bungalows have a front porch that's about 18 inches up and have this big overhanging roof. And when you're sitting in a comfortable chair on that porch, you've got amazing prospect up and down the street in this fantastic refuge space. And so this is stuff that we intuitively know, and it's just sort of saying, how do we pull these patterns and be articulate about it and intentional about it as well?
Thinking about from the individual building space to thinking about more regionally, is biophilic design in the way that Bill's been talking about it. And then when I bring in this interaction idea, I've been working for some years now on what I call interaction pattern design. So it's a different notion, a little bit different notion of a pattern. I mean, you can think of a pattern as a way of framing a form of interaction that if you see different instantiations or examples of those interactions happening, you would say, oh, that's the same thing. It's just with different nature in a different context. So walking along an edge of nature is a pattern. And if you recognize that walking along edges is just a powerful experience, then you can, that helps explain like why the seashore then all of a sudden becomes this powerful edge. But it's not just the seashore, because if you can have a lake in a city, in Seattle, we have a lake called Green Lake, and there's a path around Green Lake. And it's a marvelous design feature at a regional level that is hugely used, because I think in part it's enacting this pattern of walking an edge or running an edge or biking an edge. A pattern, the same of walking edges, is it could just be the edge of a meadow or a forest. In the same way that Bill's talking about refuge, if you're just in the middle of a meadow, it's a somewhat vulnerable spot. But if you're putting a trail in, you know, 5 feet or so from the edge of a forest in a meadow, now you have a very convivial place to walk. So that's an example of a pattern. Another pattern would be movement away from a human settlement and coming back and the return. So if we go back to biophilia and the evolutionary origins, you recognize that pattern was enacted every day of our lives, of the hunter and gatherer, of moving out. And just what Bill's talking about, there's some peril, and so you become more alert, but it's exciting, and there's a lot of attention and focus. And then the return back. Now, if we recognize that as a deep pattern in our being, if you convert railroad trails that we have in Seattle, the Burke Gilman Trail in Seattle has 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 miles now, that certainly works as a commuter pathway, biking and walking and running, but it allows people to interact with a regional landscape that you can go out a long distance, walking, running, biking, and come back. And that's just a beautiful pattern to enact. When I'm old and can barely walk, I want to be able to open the door and walk out 50 feet. And then come back. I might have a walker or something, but that's that pattern being enacted. So if we recognize the patterns of interaction that we want to foster, we can have more wild versions of it and more domestic versions of it. Domestic are important, of course, but what I would also highlight, going back to Wilson's account of biophilia and the more wild evolutionary origins of us as a species, we need more wildness in our lives. And I'll just say it straight. I think we as environmentalists have gotten too soft. I think it's part of our own shifting baseline, our own conditioning, that we're born into an increasingly urban world. And now, as we as environmentalists are talking about nature, we are often talking about the importance of local domestic nature. And of course, that's important. But I do think that we need to push back on that too, and always keep open, how can we take these interactions and make them, in our design of regional environments, make them slightly more wild, slightly bigger, slightly more autonomous, self-organizing, and be beautiful relationships that we form with nature then, not only for, again, for our physical and psychological health, but for the depth of the human spirit.
I'd like to loop back to Peter's comment about wild nature and thinking about you know, how excited people are that there's a mountain lion living you know, near Topanga Canyon, and how many people track that that animal, and the peregrine falcons in New York City, and you know, these, you know, and the leopards in Mumbai that, you know, people know are there and are tracking, and how that's, you know, that's part of, that's wild nature. And those are, you know, those are things that will eat you, and yet we are accepting and having them living, you know, near us. And this idea that, you know, maybe we can have dangerous animals around again, but we have to learn how to live with them. And, you know, as Rob Watson at NRDC used to say, there are 7 billion people, there are 5,000 tigers. I think we won this contest. Are we going to be good winners, right? And make sure that we keep some of those other species around with us, because otherwise it's going to get kind of lonely.
Well, and you were saying that one of the nature in the space approaches is having animals in the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we typically default to, you know, aquariums and bird cages and dogs and cats and domestic animals. But it is pretty exciting to see, you know, the support for having hawks nesting on tall buildings in major cities, and, you know, the people, the cameras then, and people really engaging in that, and seeing the ospreys come back to harbors, and seeing, you know, that connection with nature coming back, and people getting excited about that and realizing, you know, the importance of having living predators back in healthy ecosystems.
Great. I want to loop back to one of the hurdles that Peter was talking about earlier, and it's about effectiveness and what strategies can be measured. And so for someone who wants to measure the effectiveness of what they're doing in terms of biophilic design, what would you recommend? What are some things that they could measure, some metrics that they can monitor?
In our work, we've been trying to do more and more post-occupancy work. So before an intervention, biophilic design intervention is done in a place or a space, doing physical measurements of what are the conditions in the space, doing observational studies of how people are using the space, and then doing surveys of asking people's response to the space. The intervention is then put in, and then come back and see, are there changes in people's use patterns in those spaces, and survey them as well, and see if their attitudes and what they're self-reporting about experience changes as well. You know, the biophilic interventions can be very inexpensive, or some can be pretty elaborate and expensive. Either way, we should know that, you know, we want to know that what we're doing is effective, and then catalog those so we have more and more knowledge about, okay, these are effective interventions and these are less so.
Also in our audience, we're going to have architects, engineers, construction managers, but people who operate buildings, and they can help build up the resources that can help us know what is effective, what is not. So what would you call for them? Like, what information do we need? What should we be measuring so that we can share with the community?
Well, some of the stuff that we are concerned about are thinking about interventions that require maintenance, and understanding why that, you know, it's important to maintain them. There's nothing sadder than a dying green wall, and in some ways that's really counterproductive. And just reminding folks that they have, you know, when we think about the cost of a office building, to put it in economic terms, on an annual basis, the energy cost is actually only about 1% of the building of the total building cost. And yet that's, you know, from carbon issues and operational issues and cost issues, we typically focus on that from a green building standpoint. those are important. Rent is about 9%, and the rest is the cost of the people. So to put that, you know, flip that around, a 1% gain in productivity is equivalent to the entire energy bill. And so we really, really need to focus on how do we manage buildings to support the well-being of the people in those buildings. And some of that's programmatic, and some of that is interventions. And so while it may sound crazy to spend a bunch of money supporting other living things in our spaces, it has a really significant economic benefit to our entire, to companies and families and to our overall well-being.
Great. And just to wrap it up, for the people who want to learn more and want to follow up, what are some resources that would you recommend for them?
I'll recommend a few resources that people can look at. There are a number of websites. There's the Biophilic Design Initiative that is a partnership of the Living Futures folks and Interface and Google and Terrapin and several other organizations. The Phipps Conservatory is also a major player in that. There's the Biophilic Cities Network, which is a network of cities around the world who are sharing practices about how do we bring experiences of biophilia to populations on a citywide scale, and which is really, really exciting. On our website, on terrapinbrightdream.com, we have a number of white papers and case studies that we've been publishing and collecting that people can download for free. Humanspaces.com is another website that publishes research on biophilia and biophilic design, and they have some great resources on there as well. And there are a number of great books out. There's obviously the original piece that really lays out this original science, which is the biophilia hypothesis that Peter has writing in and that was edited by Stephen Kellert and E.O. Wilson. There's Biophilic Design, which is a series of a follow-up book that is the introduction to the science of biophilic design. Our publication's 14 Patterns of Biophilic Design. There are some other great ones that are coming out in the next few months. Stephen Kellert, who unfortunately died a few months ago, his last book, I just got to finish reading it, the manuscript a few weeks ago, is going to be really fantastic, and that'll be out in early 2018. And then Amanda Sturgeon is at Living Futures has got a manuscript that's just about done on really great case studies of biophilic design as well.
Yeah, those are all fabulous. Even going back to Wilson, you know, on a very broad level, thinking of E.O. Wilson's 1984 book on biophilia, if people are interested in just seeing just an early, beautiful, almost lyrical account of how deep nature is within us. You know, and people like Paul Shepard that I mentioned, Jack Turner on the Abstract Wild, and to try to bring forward an articulation of not just the domestic, but the more wild forms of interaction. Think about a book on technological nature. It's called Technological Adaptation and the Future of Human Life. So if you're interested in the sorts of studies you were talking about with window display and what those studies look like, as well as the larger issue of can we adapt out of this problem. That's a nice resource. I have an edited volume with a collaborator on the rediscovery of the wild. So that follows people like Dave Foreman and Paul Shepard and others trying to speak about the power of wildness in human lives, and also an edited volume in ecopsychology that talks about the power of nature within human lives. So those are more broad resources, but if you're really interested in the practice and the built environment, I think the references that Bill is highlighting are just go-to places, and he and his firm have been leading biophilic design nationally, internationally. So just very exciting work that he's been doing.
But we're so excited to have the two of you. Thank you so much. This has been incredibly interesting, and we're so excited to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this engaging conversation with Peter Kahn from the Department of Psychology at the University of Washington and Bill Browning from Terrapin Bright Green. our guests discuss the physical and psychological benefits of interacting with nature and some strategies to incorporate nature in the space, natural analogs, and nature of the space as part of biophilic design. To learn more, check out the biophilia courses on the education platform at usgbc.org, including Green Design, Biophilia and the Human Affinity for Nature, and Biophilia, Moving from Theory to Reality. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Built for Health by USGBC. Now we want to hear from you. What was your favorite part of today's episode? What are your best practices and strategies? Share with us on Facebook or Twitter at USGBC. To learn more, visit our website at usgbc.org. Thanks for listening.